There's no language to describe what I've just told you about. So that a couple having problems in their relationship, in their marriage, haven't the way, haven't the words, the concepts with which to see about the degree to which the class relationship they are in the household, is a problem for their psyche, for their relationship, for their sense of self, for their happiness. I don't want to argue that Marxism is a mechanism to be happier in your personal life, but it is something I would argue you ought to think about. Take a step back. Is it possible that Americans in traditional households have, without the language, nonetheless figured out here some of this? Of course they have. Some interesting statistics. We have one of the highest divorce rates in the Western world, or for that matter, anywhere in the world, here in the United States. More interesting than that is that the fastest growing kind of family in the United States is one, or household, is one in which no feudal exploitation occurs. The fastest kind of family growing in the United States is called the single adult family. That's with an adult male or an adult female, with or without children, living alone, without another adult, without another person to produce a surplus for. The language these people use to describe how they ended up in that situation is as varied as you could imagine. It tends to have only in common the absence of all class analytics and all class vocabulary because it's unfamiliar. People don't know that way of thinking. Just like people who have never been exposed to psychology can't interrogate their unconscious because they're not aware they have one. They think when they have a dream, it's about something bad they ate, not about a desire they have that they can't confront in their waking life. They never read Freud's interpretation of dreams or the vast psychological practice that has grown out of that book. So what has happened is that actually in the United States and in other countries, people have increasingly walked away from an unbearable feudal class structure. I will not live like that. I observed my mother and father locked into a relationship that I will spend my entire life not repeating. If you're honest enough even to admit that to yourself. Some are, some aren't. But they walked away. They are going to live in a way completely different, having therefore very complicated Thanksgiving and Christmas gatherings where they have to try to explain directly or indirectly how it is that they're not living like all those other people in the family and what is going on and what's wrong with you and all of that. What are the other forms? Well, there are two. One is the ancient class structure, the self-employed home worker. The man or woman who by themselves cooks and cleans and repairs and all the rest of it. And they produce a surplus too, but they themselves get it because there's nobody else there except the dog. So what's happening here? This is, and I want to make it dramatic because I want you to see what's at stake. There has been in the United States, particularly in the last 30 years, nothing less than a class revolution in the class structure of the household. We on the left, Marxist and non-Marxist alike, didn't notice. We thought class, and therefore class revolutions, only happened in the workplace. We weren't paying attention. It happened in the home. One class structure was destroyed. People walked away. Women, particularly, because they're the leading force in all of this, they went on strike. That is, it's a rough equivalent to what workers would have done if capitalism at the workplace had become unbearable. They would have walked away. I won't do it. Well, the way this is done in the household is, I refuse. I will get divorced, or I will never enter into a feudal class structure. I either have no marriage at all, or a marriage, but not in a household. 100 ways people are trying to do this. But there is a second one I don't want to lose sight of. It's much smaller, but it's happening all over the United States. That's not a feudal household. It's not an ancient household. It's not slavery. It's not capitalism. Those are really out. Communism. Yes. There are groups of people, more than two, deciding to live together. Maybe because they're sharing expenses. There are 100 reasons. Maybe because they have a different idea of their sexual interactions. All kinds of things. But they live together in groups, 3, 4, 5, 10. And guess what? Many of them are very determined to divide the labor up, kind of equally. Men and women, older, younger, whatever, divide the work and together produce enough to sustain themselves inside the household and a surplus, which is then distributed in whatever ways they want. You're going to see some of that in a few minutes. In other words, it's a collective or a communist household. In the 1960s and 70s, the people who did this called them communes sometimes. Hint. Even if they weren't aware of the class, they knew somewhere that they were doing something like this. So there are multiple class-structured households, even here in the United States today. And the one, the ancient one, is in a position to very dramatically alter American life because it's so big. Because it is the major way that people walking away from a feudal class structured relationship are now trying to organize. One more. There are a growing number of households of two adults, man, woman, or two men, two women, that really doesn't matter for this point, who are determined to try, even in that small frame, to have a communist household. Particularly younger people. When you ask younger women and younger Americans, survey after survey in the United States the last 20 years, the women and the men agree that they should share the housework. The cooking, the cleaning, the dishwashing, all of it. Women are making that demand. Men, more or less grudgingly, accept it. Not everywhere, not always, not in a straight line. But it's a clear trend. And so this is interesting too. It means that the revolution against the traditional feudal class structured household has gone so far that even those who are in a, let's call it traditional, heterosexual, two-person household want to break the feudal class structure and substitute something else. The demand for equality and non-exploitation at the home, inside, in the last 25 years of American history, is as dramatic as the absence of that demand at the workplace. The same people who wouldn't dream of allowing the kind of inequality at the job, at home, seem to find it unexceptionable at the job. What a remarkable evolution. It is the uneven development of class consciousness and class struggle on these two sides, workplace, household. Remarkable. Once you see it. But in order to understand what's going on here, you have to have the conceptualization, which Marxian theory provides, and no other that I know of. And I've done a lot of work in this area. Let's now use this analysis and do some interesting work with it. First, what happens when a class revolution happens inside the household? What happens when an individual, or over a period of generations, people change the class structure in the household? Well, the answer is we don't know, but in Marxian theory, we know how to ask some questions about it. I've already hinted at it in what I just said to you. Suppose people go through a wrenching evolution, psychologically, personally, from a feudal class-structured household to another one. First question to ask. Suppose you live with a group of people in a communal household. Suppose you and your husband or you and your wife have a real egalitarian because that's how the language would be, an equal relationship, because the language of Marx is not available. So you don't say a different class structure. You don't think like that. You never heard that before. Some of your faces are giving away that you never heard it before now. Okay, it's been around a while. I don't want to embarrass you, but it has been around. Any case, here's an important question. What may happen on the job when people come to the job from a situation where they have walked away from, banned, overcome, destroyed, exploitation? Might it become, maybe it'll take a few years, might it become impossible for these people not to bring to the job the expectations and feelings about no exploitation at home? Might the man be less willing to accept exploitation on the job because he hasn't had it offset by being the exploiter at home? Might the wife, who is no longer exploited at home because it's a communal household, be goddamned if she's going to permit it on the job? I don't know. But this I know. If this analysis that we're going through now could be part of the educational activity of a leftist organization in the United States today, then there would be a hell of a lot more likely that people would bring those attitudes to the job because they would have understood the relationship between the class structure at home and the class structure at the job, and it would follow naturally that if you didn't allow exploitation at home, why the hell would you allow it on the job? Or to say the same thing, if we don't want to have exploitation at home, do we really want it on the job? Why? If we got rid of exploitation at home, for example, for the reason that the love relationship we wish to sustain inside the household was undermined, threatened, undercut, weakened by the fact that one partner of a love relationship has to produce surplus for the other with no exchange at all. One produces surplus for the other. The other does not produce surplus for the one. If we thought that love could not survive, in most cases, such a relationship in class terms, might we not ask the question whether the quality of life in the larger community is similarly undermined by the presence of exploitation on the job? If we want to have a democratic, loving, nurturing, caring society, maybe that's as undone in the larger society by exploitation on the job as our love relationships that are intimate are undone inside the home by the presence of a class exploitation there. To be able to ask that question, you need class analytical theory. It's not that it gives you the answer. It doesn't. But that's never the hard part. The hard part is always the question. Albert Einstein, very famous. The answer, he said, is easy. It's the question that's so hard to figure out. And that's what a theory is. It tells you the question. So these are very important political questions. And I'm going to come back to the political implications as we move forward. What about other class structures of the household in other parts of the world? They all have them. There are traditional, that is, feudal class structures in many parts of the world. There are communal class structures. There are ancient class structures. Okay, they exist everywhere. What really distinguishes one country from another are the particularities and the combinations. Which one is bigger? Which one is smaller? In most parts of the world, they're in flux. But let me show you how you can play with this in yet another way. Suppose, for a moment, that you had a powerful, radical, socialist, communist movement somewhere. And suppose that it was successful in making a class transformation of the worksite. In place of capitalist enterprises, it had erected communist enterprises, where workers came together and collectively decided about the work, produced a surplus together, which they collectively appropriated and distributed in the way we've talked about earlier in this course. Suppose, with me, that they did that. And suppose they shared the traditional blindness, these Marxists who had pulled it off, to the household. So they left the household pretty much as it was. So husbands and wives would go to work in a communal workplace and be equal and be unexploited. And at the end of the day, they'd come home and re-enter into the traditional relationship of husband and wife. Husband appropriating, wife producing surplus. Now here's the question Marxist theory would ask. How is this going to evolve? Is your experience in the communist class structure of the job going to be strong enough to transform the class structure of the household? Or vice versa? Will the exploitation of the household undo what you've been able to create at the workplace? The periods of communist class structures that we have, limited, the one in Russia I told you about in agriculture last time, the possibility that there were such things in the 50s in China, I'll make you a guess. Part of the reason these efforts have been as unsuccessful as they were is not because of a limitation in them, or not only that. It was also because, having not attended to the class structure of the household, it could continue and thereby undermine the grounds for the survival of a changed class structure outside. You don't attend to it, it will attend to you. Let me give you another application. So you see the power of this. Shortly after the Russian Revolution in 1917, the issue of the relationship of the Soviet Revolution to Russian women, who, if you know the way Russian society works, are the majority. The women are a larger number than men in Russia and have been for most of the, at least the last 100 years or 200 years. And many reasons for that. So the majority. Lenin, by the way, wrote extensively on the issue of women in the new society and communism, very concerned about that. In case you're not familiar, that's another one of those Marxists who did talk about it. Not enough, not in detail, not in the way it needed, but recognized it as an important issue. Okay. There was a great debate in Russia on how to deal with women. Lenin's argument was the following, very strong. Women are a degraded part of our population. One of the first and major goals of the Soviet Revolution, and he used words like liberate our women. Okay, if you're going to liberate women, what does that mean? In Russia, a debate took place right after the revolution was, now that they control the government, what were they going to do to liberate women? And here's the way the debate went. Lenin leading the way. Number one, our women are not educated. They are not comfortable in the larger society. They are not productive anywhere the way they could be. And much of this was ascribed to, in this Lenin's language, the unspeakable drudgery of housework. The idea was developed, a dominant idea in Russia at the time, that women were crucial for the success of the revolution. Women's capability to produce had to be liberated if the revolution was going to survive. It was a very urgent matter. How do you liberate women so that they could participate in the production of the new society? You had to free them, the way the logic went, from the drudgery of life in the home. All right? Now, did they use a class analysis to say that the woman's degradation came out of her class position in the household? Never. That was not, Lenin didn't look like that, didn't think like that, that was nothing like that. No. So what did Lenin and his followers, what did they see? They saw the solution not as a change in the class structure of the household from the horrible feudal household that was the norm in Russian society for centuries up to the 1917 revolt. No, he didn't think like that. So what was the solution? The solution was free women from having to do any housework at all In other words, there was not a class analysis. It was analysis that said women's dilemma is that they're working in the household. So the solution, if you think like that, is free them from that work. So in the first 10 years of the revolution, very dramatic things were done in Russia. I don't know if you know this history. I'll recount it for you briefly. Number one, all across Russia, the government set up collective laundries. You don't do any more household cleaning. You take your laundry to a central place where it is handled as a commercial industrial function, like making chairs or making books or making shoes or anything else. Likewise, all over Russia, Soviet Russia, canteens, that's what they were called in Russia, were developed. Mass eating facilities. You don't cook at home. You don't make your food at home. On the way home from your job, you stop at the canteen and pick up dinner. Now, to a modern U.S. audience, this is all familiar because you call that McDonald's. Well, because capitalists learned the lesson better than socialists. But in those days, these were revolutionary ideas. You were collectivizing, or the language in Russia at the time, industrializing housework. You were taking it out of the tasks of the woman and making it part of the social work process. Everywhere, creches is what they call them. Places for taking your toddler, your little baby. They were collective daycare, whatever you want to call it. Childcare, cooking, cleaning, and they had great plans to industrialize even the housework. Engineers went to work. All new buildings were to be constructed with each apartment having a hole in the wall with a cover that was an air-sucking machine. So everybody had a built-in vacuum cleaner. You just took and connected it to this hole in the wall, and that produced the suction that you could then go and vacuum everything. The idea, and that would not be done by you, the resident of the apartment, but would be done industrially by people who would come in and simply plug their commercial machine in there, do this all in 10 minutes, and it would be done. In other words, the liberation of women was to be accomplished by the industrialization of housework, to use their language. Now, the interesting thing about this was that it was a brilliant idea. It followed from a non-class analysis of the household, where the problem of the household was the nature of the work, not the class structure of the work. The idea was to free the women without asking the question, what about the men? Don't you need to free the man from the class structure he's woven into in the household? Isn't he also shaped by it? And isn't he shaped in ways that may be inimical to a socialist or communist future? They didn't ask that question. They saw the dilemma as the dilemma of the woman. And they were going to free her by not having her do these tasks anymore. The problem in Russia was the following. By the end of the 1920s, when they had recovered from the war through great effort, they also faced a whole new set of crises, not the least of which was being surrounded by hostile enemies. The cost of their agricultural collectivization that we talked about a little later. They made the decision they did not have enough resources, which they didn't, to do all the things they had hoped to do. So they went through a period at the end of the 1920s when they had to decide what were the priorities and what were not. And the decisions that were made, they were made in that time by Stalin because he had just defeated Trotsky in those struggles in 1925 and 26 and 27 when the two of them struggled over who would be the leader. Stalin won, Trotsky was thrown out of Russia into exile and all the rest. So Stalin made this decision that one of the things the Russians couldn't afford, he didn't say it was a good thing. He apologized. But we can't afford. It's too expensive to build the creches, the canteens, the communal laundries, to train people, to build the facilities, to build the machines, to put in the facilities. By the way, one of the things that Russia couldn't do was import equipment because nobody would lend them money and nobody would sell to them. They were banned. The United States, for example, didn't recognize the new government, banned trade, forbade trade with them, and so on. They had real problems. very different situation, for example, from what confronted the People's Republic of China after their revolution. They were not prevented from international trade to help solve their problems, and so it's a different history. In the case of the Soviet Union, they therefore made the decision, we can't afford the things that will liberate the women. And therefore, in their conception, Stalin not doing anything that anybody else wouldn't have done at that time. We understand the liberation of women to have involved the industrialization of housework. We can't afford to continue the industrialization of housework. We're very sorry, ladies. You have to go back into the household. Where else were they going to go? So they did. And that put them right back in the feudal household that had existed for the previous 500 years. So for the rest of Soviet history, starting in the late 20s, right up until the end, whatever you think was going on in Russian industry and on the Russian farm, inside the Russian household, the woman produced the surplus, the cooking and the cleaning and all the rest of the surplus, and delivered it to her husband. And all the talk about socialism and communism and equality had to coexist with that reality inside the household. My argument, one of the things that caused the Soviet Union to implode was that the majority of its people had been exploited inside the household for the entirety of modern Soviet history. And when the time came to get rid of that system, they didn't miss it. But none of that is available to you if you do not have a concept of class analysis and its applicability to the household. It was an opportunity completely missed in the Soviet Union. Imagine if they'd had the apparatus of this kind of thinking. They would have been able in the late 20s to say, okay, we can't, let's grant them, you know, as a supposition, we can't afford the industrialization of housework. We can't liberate women from doing in the house, the cooking, the cleaning, we can't afford it. Okay, that still leaves open, can we change the class structure inside the household in which this work gets done? It's not that the question got the wrong answer. It was never asked. It was thought that the household just works that way. So you liberate women by making the household no longer relevant. Or to say the same thing more technically, because it may help you gel the implications of this for the United States. The industrialization of the household meant that the idea was all production, and therefore all class, would now happen at the work site, because the home would no longer be the site of production. You don't have to worry about the class structure of the household if no work is done there. If the household becomes a pure site of consumption, then no work is done. You won't have a class structure. The society that has gone the furthest in that is the United States. Americans now buy the food, and what do they do at home? They consume it. They don't make the food. That's been a growing trend. You buy that in the plastic on the way home. Then you breathe on it to warm it up and eat it. Or if you're tired, stick it in a microwave. You don't produce hardly anything. You have your clothes cleaned somewhere else. You have someone come in who cleans the apartment. You buy ready-made everything. You buy finished everything. We are moving this culture, for other reasons, to a household in which the issue of class becomes moot because no work is done there. All work is done elsewhere. People just get together for acts of consumption, but not of production. That was the Soviet dream, to do that. They couldn't afford it. We can. And the ironies of that will be evident in all of our lives for the rest of our lives. And they are abundant. Let me turn... Yes, sir.
One quick question. Majority of the population are women. They are participating in making the revolution and constructing socialism. Why didn't they recognize what you just told them?
They did. One of the most powerful institutions in the first 10 years of the Soviet Union was something called the Women's Bureau. If you had over.
We celebrated her yesterday.
What?
It was a national holiday in Russia yesterday for that woman that started that.
Yes. I forget her name. She was on the first, she was the woman in the cabinet, the first revolutionary cabinet immediately after. Just, I block her name. It'll come to me. A very important woman. She was a leader in the reform of education and the treatment of women. There was a very strong women's movement, very powerful women's movement. But they didn't have this concept either. They supported the industrialization of housework. And when they couldn't afford it, they felt it was their loyalty to the revolution to understand that this would have to be postponed until the money was there to continue with the program of industrialization of housework. That never happened. Starting in the middle 1930s, when it was clear it wasn't going to happen, you know, they were beginning to rearm to fight the German, the wars in Germany by that time. You know, remember, Hitler comes to power in 1933, and his arch enemy is the Bolshevik Revolution, so the Russians would have had to be completely crazy not to understand they now had to defend themselves against, and so forth. So there weren't going to be any resources. In the mid-30s, you can see what Stalin does. He begins to celebrate the ancient core of our Russian homeland, which is the woman. In that, they give up the whole revolutionary rhetoric, and it becomes the way you honor women is to celebrate their selfless work at home, doing the old role, but doing it with gusto and intensity. No more liberation. It's over. Never comes back in Russia. And the bitterness of Russian women, if you read the literature, novels and so forth, in this, published in the Soviet Union after World War II, the complaint of women, the attitude of their long-suffering nature, of the burden of the Russian man, it is extraordinary. There's a woman of a joint American-Russian background. Her name, I believe, is Duplessis Gray. You may remember her. Her books were bestsellers. But she wrote books about the condition of Russian women. And they're very good. They're full of interviews with Russian women about their lives. And the bitterness and the anger and the sense of betrayal by what had gone on ran very deep. It didn't take the overt political forms because in Russia that wasn't feasible. But it's very clear and very profound, very moving, and very intimate about what the revolution had not meant for them. But if you go back to the 1920s, you'll see, very, and again, a historian of Russian women, Wendy Goldman. She's not a Marxist, she's hostile to that, but it's good work if you read outside the politics. A professor at Princeton, Wendy Goldman, I forget the title, the history of Russian women in the early period. It's very, very good. Very, very good. And there are other books. I mean, you learn about this, you can get a lot of this. Okay. Let me turn now to a couple of questions we don't have enough time to go into, but again, I'm trying to show you where I think this kind of analysis enables you to go. Let's open the question that I've left unspoken, which must be in your mind. Where in all of this fit the children? Where are the children in this story? And this is a very interesting topic on how you integrate children into the class structure of a household into which such children arrive by birth. So let's see. Let's suppose a traditional husband and wife in a feudal class relationship. He goes off to work, she stays at home, they make a decision or not. In any case, a child arrives, a baby. Now what? Well, let's see. In the early years of this new person's life, this baby eats food, must be fed, must be clothed, must be sheltered. There's a flow of products of labor that have to be provided for the consumption of this child if it is to survive, let alone grow up. First question. In this economy, how is this going to be? Where's it coming from? Where is the flow of goods to come from? Let's go through it. Here's one possibility. Here we go. Ready? One possibility. The husband to whom the wife delivers her surplus can take a cut in the surplus. in order to free her to use the extra labor she does over and above what she takes to produce herself, instead of delivering all of that to him, she's now going to deliver some of the surplus to their baby. So that's where it would come from. A deduction from his surplus to sustain the baby they produced. Option number, you can see where this is going. Option number two, she continues to deliver the same surplus to him. She takes a portion of what she produced, used to produce for herself, and gives it to the baby. She thereby reduces her own standard of living. The portion of output she used to produce and consume is now the same portion of output, but is shared between her and the baby. That's a decision that has to be made. The two may not be conscious. The two may not want to think in such terms. Too bad. The decision not only has to get made, is made. Are there still other options? Sure there are. Here's an option. You go to one or another of the set of parents of the couple and get them to use their savings to solve this problem, so you don't have to struggle, the two of you, as to who is going to be deprived for this kid. Here's another option. The government taxes everybody and takes a portion of the taxes and provides them as a subsidy for every family that has a child to pay the cost, to avoid the struggle inside the... The fact that people are not conscious of this is really not very interesting. It's a nice part of the story that people have to work out a decision they need not to be conscious of. But it is there's no way out of this. And here's a thought for you. If sustaining the child has to happen, if there's no external help, if there's no parents and no state, if it has to be worked out of the economy of the class structure of the household, somebody is going to lose, or the child is going to die. By the way, are there couples who can't work this out, and so the child dies? You betcha. You read them in the newspapers here every day. You may read it, and then the child was battered to death by the boyfriend. Yeah, sure. Why? What the newspapers do never tell us. Horrible thing happened. But why did it happen? I don't know. No analytic. Well, it may have happened because the two adults could not work that out. So it sat there as an immense, unresolved dilemma that everybody was too resentful to cope with, and the child is neglected. If not dead, hurt, sick, unattended to, underdeveloped. In child medical circles, there's a name for a disease in our country which is very widespread for small children. The name of the thing is called, in medical language, failure to thrive. There's a failure to thrive baby. That is a euphemism. That's a baby whose parents can't cope with this decision, of which they are unconscious, but of which, whether unconscious or not, they have no escape from. Or the child dies, or it is failure to thrive. So, this is enormous. What does this mean? It means that however dimly in the subconscious, people who are a couple and who are considering, given our culture, that would be likely, the question at least, shall we have some children, are in fact, whether they understand it or not, also dealing with what it will mean in their class relationship. And it's only more powerful if you're not aware of it. But the decision is there, and you're going to have to make it in somewhere you know it. You just lack all of the conceptual and vocabulary with which to understand it. A lot of work has been done, and in that book, you see the whole chapters on the children, takes this much more, and it's very interesting how this plays out. For example, just to tantalize you, in many cultures, the family that has to either take a part of the surplus or deprive the mother typically of part of her necessary consumption to sustain the baby, sometimes compensate themselves by arranging that when the child gets to be 7, 9, 11 years old, the child becomes another serf for the father, becomes a co-worker with the mother, an additional surplus producer inside the household to repay, if you like, the investment that kept them alive. That happened in many places, including in our country. Children as labor, as producers of surplus. Here's another dimension. Let's assume the child is taken care of in a traditional feudal household and is a healthy, growing young boy, young girl, etc., etc. And now let's ask a psychological question. What is the child observing in the house? He's observing a feudal father appropriating the surplus of the mother and a feudal mother producing surplus for the father. What is the child learning? What is the child seeing? That the child doesn't have a vocabulary to capture that class process. Look, that child doesn't have a vocabulary to capture the sexual dynamic between his or her parents. He doesn't understand, or the baby doesn't understand the emotional issues that they have. Has no language and concept. The parents usually don't, and they certainly don't give it to the kid, even if they do. So of course they don't have a language for this either. But because they don't have a language, you're smart enough to know, all of you, that the sexual dynamic of the parent shapes that child, and the emotional dynamics of the parent shape that child. Well, so do the class dynamics. There's an association. Man appropriator, woman exploited. This is a preparation, not just for women to replicate their mothers in how they dress and how they hold their bodies and how they think, but also in what they expect of life, what they think is the appropriate order of life. Growing up in a feudal household is training in the normality of exploitation. And what does that mean? Especially because it is so gendered in the traditional household, with the wife so overwhelmingly in the serf position and the husband so over. It would be different if those were mix and match, that we had as many households in which the wife went out and the husband stayed home to do the housework as we had the reverse. Then the gender would move out of the story, but we don't. It's a particular class structure shaped in a particularly gendered organization. And so I think that raises all kinds of questions also in our culture. Give me another example, just of the way to use it. The child who wants to break away from the parents, who goes, as many children do, in puberty or in adolescence, and needs a period of separation, particularly from the same-sex parents, but from both of them. I remember my son, whom some of you know, and my daughter, whom some of you know, and when they reached the high school years, had to inform me that I really was one of the most odious persons that the world had yet produced, and they enjoyed repeating that, and et cetera, et cetera. And that was a hard time for me. It was a hard time for me, especially when they did it more to me than to my wife. But in any case, it was a hard time. And in that moment of breaking away and separation, which I recognize the need for, and which I'm happy to say they got through, or more happy to say I got through, the question always in my mind from this class analysis is, how much of the rebellion then has a class dimension? When they rebel, do they rebel from the way I talk, or the way I look, or the way I dress, or whatever? But is it also a break from the class position of the household? And how might that work out, and what directions might... Those are fascinating. I don't know what the answers are. I don't think the work has yet been done to try to think through what the implications, all the implications are of a class structure inside the household that is real, that engages intensely the lives of the adults and of the children, and so on. One final example. If you're wealthy, or at least you have some money, you can bring another person into the household, a paid household worker, a maid, a butler, a cook, or whatever. And that introduces a whole other thing. Now you've added into the family unit an outside person, say not related by kinship, who comes in and does labor. You buy so many hours of his or her work. They come to your house and they do cooking, cleaning, whatever it is. And that then becomes an interesting thing because you've introduced into the household now an exchange relationship among people in the household. You didn't have that before. There's no exchange. Mother and father don't buy things from one another. Parents and children do not do that in general. But now you have a person who's regularly there only because an exchange. And you've brought exchange into the household. Here's an irony of our culture. We don't do that a lot. And we kind of frown on it unless we're wealthy. And so I'm going to tell you a story which some of you have heard before, but it always has a wonderful effect. Imagine the following. A young person who's going to college and taking courses in economics, where he or she learns that the most magical institution that the world has ever developed, that creates efficiency and prosperity wherever it arrives, is called the market. Much better than any other way to distribute goods and services amongst us is a market. You only buy what you want. So the things you buy are the things you want. And we only produce what people buy, so all we produce is what people want, which is, after all, what we should produce. So the market is this wonderful device that gets us just to produce what we all want. At this point, you know, we play the national anthem, hold our hands over our hearts, and say, thank you, God, for giving us the market. And after, you know, you all learn that in school, and you learn it in the newspaper, and every politician intones this stuff, then I like to tell this story. Imagine your home for the holidays. And your whole family is gathered around the table, and in my hypothetical household, let's say it's Thanksgiving, so you're all going to eat a big turkey, and your mother, typically, or maybe your mother and father in your home, bring out the lovely roasted turkey and present it on the table, and all of the assembled family are sitting around the table, and you eat the turkey and all the equipment that goes with it. Now, let's imagine the meal is over, everybody's suitably stuffed and all the rest. And so a cleanup has to begin. So mother or father leans across the table to you, you're a young person home for the holidays, and says, Mary or Billy, whatever your name is, would you please clean the plates off? And Billy, just back from college, where he learned about the efficiency of the market, says, sure, Ma, that'll be $4. Well, I'm performing a service. And you should pay for the service because we buy and sell. That's efficient. Now, what that child is doing is the most logical thing in the world. Learned this is the best way to do things and is bringing that, watch it now, bringing that inside the household. No sooner has Billy said, Mom, $4, than father leans across the table, smacks Billy right across the face, and then gives him a lecture. That's disgusting, Billy. What are you doing? Watch the language now. Billy, in this household, we don't ask for money from one another. We love each other here. We want to do things for one another. We do things out of a desire to be helpful, to be a good member of the family, to help each other, to support each other. That's disgusting. Poor Billy is all confused. He's having to learn the lesson that this culture's celebration of the market is only a celebration of the market outside the household. Bring that institution inside and we will smack you. And the reasoning is wonderful. To bring in the market destroys love. I got a newsflash for you. If bringing the market in destroys love inside the family, here's a thought. Maybe it does that outside too. Uh-oh. Can't have that thought. That's why this story I just told you always seems to hit people. It never seemed to... That's how normalized we have been in the schizophrenia that what goes on inside the household is a completely different realm from what goes. Nothing applies, no comparison, no parallel. It's as if we didn't all live in both places and were therefore not all affected by both places and by the class structures in both. Let me conclude, a little bit of time I have, by using this analysis to tell a sad story about American U.S. politics in the last 30 years. Starting in the 1970s, American industry found itself in a terrible bind. It had had 30 years of unmitigated prosperity, 1945 to 1975. Why? Because we were the only country to come out of World War II with our industrial system intact. In fact, the war had been the best thing. It got us out of the Depression, put all our people back to work. We had full employment, and we were producing tons of stuff. The rest of the world had been decimated by the Depression and then by the war, which was fought in all the most advanced capitalist countries. Japan was a wreck, Germany was a wreck, Britain was a wreck, France was a wreck, and Russia was a wreck. Not that they could have competed, they were too poor, but they were at least a big country. So we were king of the hill. We could produce whatever we wanted, we were the only country doing it. We could charge any price we wanted, because if you wanted to have a nice car in the 1950s, you bought an American car. Nobody didn't go anywhere else. If you wanted a TV, here. You wanted, fill in the blank. By the 1970s, American corporations found that they had no longer had this nice period. The Germans had recovered and rebuilt. The Japanese had recovered. You all knew that because you suddenly started seeing Volkswagens and Toyotas and Hondas everywhere. And the television might still say GE, but it wasn't made here. It was made over there someplace. So the American capitalist industrial population had a crisis on their hand, and what were they going to do? And here's what they did. One, they moved production out of the United States. To better compete with their new competitors, they needed cheaper workers, and they went and found them all over the world. You know that story. Second thing, they wanted to be able to compete better, so they didn't want to have to pay all these taxes to the government. They hadn't minded from 45 to 75, because they were making so much money giving taxes to the government, letting there be all kinds of social welfare programs was okay. Kept the workers happy, no industrial trouble, weakened the unions, weakened the left, fine. But after the 1970s, they didn't want to do this anymore. So they made an attack on the government. You all know Ronald Reagan, the government's a terrible thing, don't trust the bums, blah, 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 blah. Cut the taxes on business, cut the taxes on rich, which we did. Now comes the Marxian class analysis. I am going to make a long, difficult story simple. It worked for corporations. By lowering the taxes, they had a lot of more money to invest in, develop their technology. By moving jobs out of the country, they made people in this country more desperate, willing to work for no rise in wages. And wages stopped rising in the 1970s and never resumed in America. We have the same real wage today that we did in the late 70s, United States, per hour. In terms of what you can buy, same wage. 30 years, no increase in wages. So the corporations got it. And the corporations became very powerful and very profitable for the last 30 years. Now it's all blown up. But keep in mind, from 1980 to 2007, this was the greatest sustained boom in the history of U.S. capitalist enterprises. Was it therefore a success, this conservative policy, at least for those 30 years? The answer is yes and no. Yes, for the class structure of enterprises, of capitalist enterprises. No, for the class structure of American households. Because in those 30 years, by keeping the wages down, by cutting back on government programs, what happened was you took the old feudal class structure of the American household and you subjected it to a level of pressures it could not support. Here's the result. Our families are gone. We have the highest divorce rate. Over the last 30 years, television even became endemic with stories of wife abuse, child abuse, elder abuse. We kick the animals, the fish. What is it going on? This is a country that's in extraordinary difficulty. The relation between parents and children atrophied. The stories are endless. And here's the worst of it. Did the left in America, and I mean everything from liberals on over, did they understand that there was a crisis in the family? That you had destroyed the class structure and that people were now going to go crazy, including finding new class structures, like those communal households, like those ancient households we talked about. But that they were always also going to become feeling terrible because what they had expected and what they thought life was about at home couldn't be sustained. The left had nothing to say. The Marxist left had nothing to say. And so this revolution that was building, the trauma, the suffering, and the revolutionary changes were dealt with by the left as if they weren't occurring. That was a disaster. That was a missed opportunity of epic historic importance. Imagine a left that could have had an explanation of the sort I've tried to give you, that could have had a suggestion of recipes for how to deal with this, with asking the people to vote for people who were going to solve these problems, recognizing them and their importance. None of that happened. Instead, somebody else found an opportunity. The Christian right, the Republican, on the extremes, they set up a chant, family values, bring back the good old days. At least it was a recognition that the family and the falling apart of the family is an urgent political matter because it's an urgent life experience people are going through. So the right to this day speaks to that. You may make fun of Sarah Palin, but that's what her shtick is. That's what she's doing. I'm a mom. I'm holding it together, despite having a child with a mental problem. Look, I'm struggling like we are. She's talking. What's the alternative? What's coming from the left? Nothing. Nothing. Democrats are cutting programs for families too, like the Republicans. But they don't have any language even, not even a fake one. Nothing. It's as if, as I started tonight, it's as if analyzing the household, let alone analyzing it as a class place under pressure, going through a revolution, doesn't count. Doesn't even exist. This class analysis of Marxism is a way for the left in the United States to become relevant politically again by speaking to a class structure inside the household and not just to those outside. Failure to do that seeds political space to the right, which couldn't be a more dangerous thing to do at this point in our history than anything I can think of.
If you'd like to download this or any of our 620 something previous episodes, you can do so from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net. We have a Twitter feed, twitter.com/unwelcomeguests, announcing new episodes, and there's a mailing list if you air the show or if you're otherwise interested in discussing content for future episodes. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. A listener the other day emailed me to say, after listening to a lot of Unwelcome Guests, he was finding it easier to discuss these sort of topics with the people around him. What an encouraging email. And just as Richard Wolff talks about giving people a language to describe what's going on, it's one of the things that I try and do in the show, and try and present important ideas. We've looked before at the social atomization, the fact that people don't produce things together, they only consume things together. Charles Eisenstein's good on that point. I hope this episode has helped to elucidate the systemic pressures, the bigger pictures, which create the small details that we sometimes focus on the show. And I hope it'll help you to discuss these points with those around you.